Actually, I'm impressed. We're competing against Disney World. It's 12:30 in the afternoon on a Tuesday and free time afterwards from now until buffet suppers, right? So thank you for attending. We'll try to make it as interesting as, hopefully not as Mickey Mouse, but maybe Pirates of the Caribbean or something. In fact, definitely not a small world. So thanks for attending. I'm Bob Wolf. I'm a consultant from Chicago, where I believe it's also 92 degrees. So the weather's kind of great. Go to Florida to get to the heat, but it's already there. But anyway, thanks for attending the session. The name of the session has a great ring to it. I really like it, the power of an ERM program. At the end of the day, what is the power of it? It's really simple, you know. It's diversification, correlation, things that we've already studied, learned, and used, and applied, and considered, and throughout our entire careers and starting our careers. So I'm sure you're sick of this definition, because if you've been to the other ERM sessions or the one in the general session, you've probably heard this over and over and over again. But every one of us, our presentations, seems to start with this definition because it is the starting point. What is it? What is ERM, I should say? Well, the key here is assess, control, exploit, finances, and monitors risk. There is no power in ERM if there is no diversification effect, or the tools don't have any play on the correlation of risks, right? Because that's really what risk management's all about. It's applying and using diversification to reduce risk, increase predictability, but correlations, the domino effects, if we miss those, you know, which is really the power of ERM, if we miss those, there really is no effect of an ERM program. So a key element, again, is value creation from the use of ERM. So it really should be called, and I think some firms already call it that, ERRM, Enterprise Risk and Return Management, because enterprise risk is really, if why apply it if it doesn't create any sort of value or benefit? So it really should be ERRM. I think Allstate uses that term already. Anybody from Allstate here? It's essentially, and I think it was mentioned in the general session Monday morning, it's not reflective of any new concepts. Like I said, diversification and correlation, we've talked about that all our careers. We are basically assessing the same issues we've already addressed, but it's an evolving organizing concept by applying our approaches and disciplines and our skill sets to manage and measure opportunities, constraints, and threats. But now we're putting it all together. That's what ERM really is. It's putting it all together and thinking holistically. How many times have you heard holistic in all this? Holistically instead of silos. COSO, the COSO definition of ERM, or the framework of ERM, relative to the CAS definition, our definition is definitely more comprehensive than the framework mentioned by COSO. Its focus is an attempt to link, which is great stuff, operational, financial, and strategic decision-making within an organization. Good stuff. Increased transparency, always good. Financial disclosure, always good. You know, checks and balances on regulatory and other compliance. And if you were in the session or ERM 101 yesterday, you know, Mark Vonamy is basically compliance-oriented. You know, check, 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 done. Where our definition, the CAS's definition, good stuff, but bottom line, there are risks, there's ways to manage it, ways to exploit it, ways to take advantage of it, and it's to increase value. Return risk. It's what we've been doing all our careers. Again, limited to diagnostics and procedures. Good stuff, but it's limited to diagnostics and procedures. I really like this chart. Actually, I stole this one from Steve Lowe because it really puts the perspective all together. There's a cost of taking risk, there's a return on taking risk, hopefully. And that's that balance that creates the value, the pinnacle, so to speak, on the top. That's what ERM is all about. That's where the CAS definition takes that into a new, you know, into that advanced, more comprehensive framework than, say, COSO and other professional associations. But again, why does it add value? Just mentioned it. It optimizes the characteristics and tools that we already have. And involves, guess what? The laws of probability and statistics. Diversification. You know, the more risks you have and are not perfectly correlated, you know, the more predictive is that portfolio of risks, whether it's homeowners policies or insuring in Florida relative to Iowa and so forth. correlation, the domino effects. We've always looked more into diversification than the domino effects. And Chet, who I'm going to be introducing in a minute, is going to talk about his experiences on domino effects. You know, basically his experiences in Pennsylvania, in terms of some of the insurance company failures, and basically how domino effects can really start much earlier in the process. What is correlation? I mean, let's get back to basics. Well, there are two variables that tend to move in the same direction, right? Doesn't have to be causal. One thing causes the other. It's just two things moving in the same direction. They could be causal. You know, commercial building fires and, okay, employee injuries. They tend to move together. That's causal. When risks are managed in silos, as has been the traditional risk management approach, the potential domino effects can be missed. I mean, obviously, causal relationships don't get missed, but other relationships can be missed. Now, I'm going to segue a little bit into this thing, because, and I'll I'll tell you where I'm going with this. There was a study done about 10 years ago that I've presented previously, which provided a study on the reasons for major stock price declines. And we're not talking about even insurance, just purely insurance companies. Now, we're talking about just corporate America. Fortune 1,000 companies over a five-year period. They were often multiple reasons, seldom a single cause, as we always try to figure out why solvencies went their various ways. And there have always been unanticipated correlated impacts. One leads to the other, which leads to the other, which leads to the other, and so forth. And this was the study. And this was a decade ago. So this is the wonderful 90s when our economy kind of was booming more than at any period in our history. This is before the dot-com collapse. This is before the corporate corruption era, or some of those things. And basically, in that period, 10% of the Fortune 1000 companies suffered a loss of over 25,000 of shareholder value within a month. Okay, and the biases are really limited here because the companies that were selected were those that were actually had premiums to earnings. Price to earnings multipliers greater than one, and we're making some money. So the causes of the drops were not systematic type risks. They were pretty much company specific risks. So it was a good sample in hindsight to draw from, because the period from 93 to 98 when this study was done, or the sample was selected, really reflected the drops and eliminated the biases caused by systematic risk, but more company specific. And again, strategic risk, dominations, operational risk, you know, combined, that's 89% of the risk. Financial and hazard, they were just kind of, okay, insurance works. That's a good thing to know about our profession. Insurance works. None of those drops were due to hazard risks, hurricanes, or anything of that sort, because they were well managed. I already mentioned this. Data was just, in hindsight, selected and chosen to eliminate the bias because of this period. By industry, it was healthcare that dominated most of the drops during that period, followed by communications and information entertainment, services, and retail. I don't know, do you recall this study by Mercer Management? You were a Guy Carpenter. You don't remember this? Okay. I was talking to Gary there. So one could say, at least based on this period, that these industries particularly could have used some more enterprise-wide risk management type strategies to avoid some of these multiple stock drops. After the stock drop, the 100 companies that were studied, they never recovered over the next 24-month period. So because once you dropped by that much, it takes more than 2 years to come back. Surprise, surprise, the major stock drops usually occurred in the months when quarterly earnings were announced. No surprise there, right? By implication, how a company releases the negative earnings does result in the volatility of market reactions. So, again, the way that it was studied, we relied upon, you know, I helped out near the trail end in terms of interpreting this when I was at Mercer in those years, but they relied upon actual writings, investment bank analyst reports, newspaper and magazine articles. But in my helping to try to interpret the causes, or peer reviewing them, they were mostly multiple causes. you know, a primary was selected that we thought was, you know, from a team of us, you know, we've kind of selected it. But in five cases, we couldn't even pick a primary cause. Couldn't even be determined. So where am I going with all this? You know, since most of the earnings drops results from multiple causes, we realized that some of those multiple causes were domino effects. You know, as Chet's going to talk about in, you know, the insurance industry, and you know, especially from his experiences in Pennsylvania, there's not one single cause. You know, reserve inadequacies, that caused the insolvency. Well, something caused the reserve inadequacies. Something caused the pricing inadequacies, which caused the reserve inadequacies. Somebody caused the liquidity drains, and you know, Chet's going to talk more about that. But only an integrated approach to risk assessment, quantification, and management mitigate against the risk of major stock value drops. Again, this is generic. This is across all of corporate America. So what could have been, what kind of risk mitigation strategies could be used? Well, in some of these drops, financial derivatives could transfer some risks. Scenario planning, game theory could anticipate competitive pressures. Customer risks, you know, some misaligned products, channels, demand shortfalls could be, you know, do some customer research, could anticipate. So again, a lot of tools in the enterprise risk management process maybe could not avoid it, but maybe mitigate against the potential, you know, magnitude of the drop. Accounting irregularities, proper audit process could prevent. You know, we got Sarbanes-Oxley and all kinds of great stuff now. That could have prevented some of that. Supply chain problems and other risks. But it looks like insurance worked. Insurance did work because hazard risk didn't even play a role here. Typical Fortune 1000 company, you can say that the 100 companies out of the 1000 that were looked at, 10% chance of losing at least a fourth of their value due to company specific problems was kind of the implication of the study. Again, it's during that period, but it was the least biased period. So it's kind of an interesting thing. Example of a strategy taking into account correlation and diversification. Let's use our favorite airline. You know, jet fuel rises. It correlates with other things, right? Once jet fuel rises, a lot of things happen. Well, it increases expenses. So guess what United, American, and all those airlines do? They raise fares. So that's one strategy. Okay. So increase expenses, that's bad. I'm thinking from the airline's perspective right now. Increasing expense, that's bad, but I raise fare, that's good. Cut bonuses for employees. Okay, that reduces expenses. That's good. Not for the employees, but for the airline. Stock price drops. That's bad. Fewer passenger miles. That's bad. Decreased maintenance expense. That's good. See what I'm getting at? There's a domino effects of good and bad stuff. Decreased advertising. Employee layoffs. Workers' compensations are up. You know, people get laid off for whatever reason. Comp costs are up, right? Lower levels of space is needed. That's good. Prices fall on rental space. That's good. So you see what I'm saying? There's these domino effects where there's not a natural causation of jet fuel with all these things, but there is positive and negative correlations. And if you just follow those domino effects, you can apply some tools to help hedge against those. And that's really the power of enterprise risk management type tools. So let's see, what could you do when jet fuel goes up? Purchase a call option on the crude oil, sell calls on the stock, because the stock drops, you know. Negotiate for future aircraft when prices are at their highest. You can have a variable contract with advertisers, depending on the cost of jet fuel. Doesn't make sense, does it, in terms of causation, but you got those hedges to play with. Workers' compensation, you inversely work with your retention and relate that to fuel prices. What does workers' comp have to do with fuel prices? But the correlation, you can play with the correlation to hedge. You tie your lease negotiations to fuel prices. So you follow the domino effect and you can hedge. You can apply tools to hedge. That's kind of that's the power. Oops. It's my power. That's the power of an ERM type approach. The challenges that I've seen and personally have experienced at companies in implementing strategies and or approaches to this? Well, first of all, let's face it, it's difficult to measure correlation. You know, you isolate the historical relationships over the years, and are they the same relationships next year and the year after? So is that correlation matrix valid in the year 1999 as well as to the year 2007? Things like that. And there we got these things, which is the biggest constraint. It's operational. Corporate constraints to integrating risk. Budgets drive corporate behavior. Do you really care about integrating and worrying about SBU A versus SBU B because you're being rewarded or punished on your own SBU? Incentive compensation needs to change in order to truly employ a top-down enterprise risk management approach to really exploit and put opportunistic strategies in place at a company. Trading mentality. Now, I'm not a trader, never been a trader, but trading is so much fun. Sometimes companies just overtrade, right? They have fun doing it. It's their job. My job is to trade, so therefore I'm going to trade, whether it's to the best advantage of overall or not. What are you really diversifying or hedging? So you got to trading, you got to consider it from the top down. Not particularly concerned with things that haven't happened recently. You don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, so it couldn't possibly happen. So therefore, what's the sense of diversifying or hedging or worrying about it? Static inertia. It's always been done that way or not done that way. And typical risk managers at corporations are still seen as risk as an insurance buyer, okay? But to truly take advantage of correlations and diversifications within the company in an ERM program, they have to be seen, and you have to integrate more of the skills of insurance buying, but also those natural hedges in the example that I provided a few minutes ago. But with that, what I'm going to do now is hand it over to Chet, because now we're gonna talk about domino effects in for P&C insurance. I just wanted to cover the basics about how tools can be used and how, because there are domino effects in P&C insurance companies that we all know, and that's how most insolvencies happen. And Chet has got dramatic experience in his own when he was a commissioner in his own state. But he's not a commissioner now. He manages the research and development department of the Donegal Insurance Group in Marietta, Pennsylvania. Previously served, as I mentioned, with the Pennsylvania Insurance Department since 86. Served as the chief actuary of the department from 89 on. Was active participant in the Pennsylvania's personal auto workers' comp, medical malpractice, health insurance reform initiatives for a 10-year period. He represented the commissioner at the State Workers' Comp Workers Insurance Fund Board and provided actuarial services to the fund. He represented the commission and department on various NAIC committees, including Life and Health Actuarial Task Force and the Casualty Actuarial Task Force. Began his career at Reliance in Philadelphia as an operations research analyst in the planning department. He's authored, he's a fellow of the Casualty Actuarial Society, a member of the American Academy of Actuaries, currently serves on many committees, chairs the CLRS, authored many papers on leverage ratios and rate rollbacks and things of that sort. He's got an MA in economics from statistics from Temple University. And resides in Chocolate Town, or near Chocolate Town, right? Hershey, Pennsylvania. Boy, every time I go to Hershey, I smell chocolate, just always. That's amazing. With his three daughters. With that, I'll give it to Chet. You know how to do that.
Well, hopefully I'll figure it out. There we go. Good afternoon. Make sure I get this. Good afternoon. I'm always, can everybody hear me? Good. Good afternoon. I'll start all over again. I'm always very flattered to get the opportunity to come and speak with a group of peers in the actuarial profession, and this is no exception. Although it is quite humid out there and much more humid than I expected. And I got here at 2:30 this morning after another luggage snafu, but I'm trying to see the humor in life. And speaking of humor, I have a friend at work that thinks that I'm a geek because I know math, but the friend is a really nice person, and I try to impress upon that friend that I'm not totally a geek by coming up with math jokes. And a recent one that I shared with this friend is as follows. There was a group hiking through the Moab area in the canyons. The group included an actuary, a mathematician, and a philosopher. And they were wandering around, and eventually the actuary noticed that they had gone full circle. And the group of them sat down and pondered it for a while and said, "We're lost." And so the mathematician yelled out, because of the echoes, "Help! Does anyone know where we're at?" And they all sat down, and there was no response for 15 minutes. There was no response for 20 minutes. Finally, a half an hour later, they heard, coming back to them, "You're lost!" And the philosopher looked at the other two and said, "Well, we know that we got an answer from a mathematician." And the other two looked at him and said, "Well, how do you know that?" And he said, "Well, it took them a long time to give us an answer. The answer was completely correct, and the answer was completely useless. So I have a lot of time to fill. Hopefully there'll be some accuracy to what I'm about to say, and hopefully there will be some usefulness." And if you're not going to laugh, that's about as, I'm a humorless fellow, so that's about as good as it gets. And actually, when Bob asked me to do this, I was mulling over some old slides on this subject and rearranging them to talk about the subject when I thought, you know, life goes full circle. When I started studying for the exams, I gave up cycling, and as you're going to learn as I proceed through this, I've gotten back into it quite intensely. But I also remembered that really this presentation, a cornerstone of it, is really an experience at Reliance Insurance Company. And I thought to myself, how ironic and how full circle this is when you step back and think about it. Because, and I hate to admit this, but in the late 70s, early 80s, when I was this wet behind the ears kid, and I went there to Reliance, some of the things I heard the wily old veterans talking about that I was really impressed with were some synergies that existed in the marketplace, including, and I remember them talking about, the energy crisis and the positive effect it was having on personal auto experience at the time because people were driving less. And at the same time, because of that energy crisis and because of the rampant inflation that it triggered throughout the economy, there was another effect, which was hyperinflation that had gone through the economy, which affected interest rates, which affected liability claims. And at the same time, I remember someone else talking to me once when I asked, well, why do we write personal lines and why do we write commercial lines? And the comment was made to me because it's our belief that there's kind of a diversifying effect riding the two, because generally, when the economy's healthy, people drive more and there are more accidents, but there are fewer workers' comp claims. And just the opposite happens when the economy goes in the tank, that they drive less, the personal auto experience improves, but the comp deteriorates because there are more comp claims filed. So these notions of correlation and diversification are not new notions. What is new, perhaps, is our ability to quantify them in some sense. But before I move on and talk about quantifying, I just want to point out that I'm no great guru or geek. I'm just kind of a washed-up old athlete. And I say that because I want to take a moment here to remind all of us about Greek tragedies. And there's a fatal flaw in Greek tragedies, and that fatal flaw usually centers around hubris, our thinking that we've got the world licked. Or there's a more colorful way to say it, but I'm not going to say that. In Greek tragedies, there's also something that often happens. Often a god will come out of the sky, and they used to call this in Greek the Deus ex machina, which actually the Latin for the Greek, which means the god on the machine or the god from the machine, and he'd come out and save the day. And what I'm about to say is really there's really, and I guess I should say, there's the devil ex machina that I'm about to talk to in several of these instances, because I think it's critical that really what we identify with correlation and diversification is a milieu or an environment, but there's something else that often happens that triggers the collapse. And that's not necessarily predictable, perhaps estimable in a probabilistic sense, but not predictable. Along the way, leading up to this, I'm reading a lot, I don't know why, but a book that I recently read and that I found at Barnes & Noble that in one of those stacks that's the $5 books was something called Deep Survival. And a lesson that I learned from Deep Survival, because it examined all these incidents of all of these survivals or lack of survival occasions that happened in life. They included people climbing the Himalayas and other things like that. And there was one common theme that what got people into trouble was all of a sudden they acted almost irrationally. They forgot reason. They went outside of their normal rules, and it was almost instinctive or almost not thought about. And there's a lesson in that that I think is a lesson that applies to some of what we're going to talk about. And actually, I have a personal anecdote along those lines. Getting back to cycling, I ride in some tours that raise money for charities. And a couple weeks ago, I rode in one called the Lancaster Farmland Preservation Trust. And getting back to Lancaster and Chocolate Town, really, if you live in that area, and the reason Milton Hershey built the plant there was because in addition to having a very hard-working labor force there, there was also a great deal of milk production, very convenient to the plant. When I first moved up to Lancaster County, I discovered two things. There is more than one chocolate maker there. And if you live where I live, depending on where the wind is blowing from, you smell one of two things. You either smell chocolate, or you smell what the farmers put on the field to encourage the growth of the crops that feed the cows. But after you've been there a while, they're both healthy smells. So in any event. But I was riding in the Lancaster Farmland Preservation Trust ride a few weeks ago, and in front of me was a pack of women, and one of them had this incredible proliferation of tattoos all over her. And I was fixated by the tattoos. And I was just trying to figure out what they all were. And I was by myself, and I was just trying to figure out what they all were, what the purpose was, what this one was, why would you do this? And my pace was pretty high, and all of a sudden, and I was a few feet behind them, and all of a sudden, we came into a turn at maybe 18 miles an hour, and guess what? The turn was going to make a quick 90-degree turn to the left, and then a 90-degree turn to the right, and they just abruptly stopped. And I guess, for some reason, I jammed on the brakes. Well, if you jam on the brakes too abruptly, bad things can happen, and actually the back wheel started the fishtail. And I guess in some sense, instinctively, something told me, well, you got to get off the brakes. And fortunately, I didn't crash. But the lesson that I learned that day was that I was getting out of my game, that I was not being as attentive to detail. I had lost focus on safety. And in fact, yes, there's risk that I take when I ride a bike, but the risk is manageable. But what had I done? I had gotten out of my game. I had lost focus, and I was taking risk by not being attentive. Well, this last weekend, I was in another tour, and I came to an intersection, and it wasn't a race. It was just a tour. And I was coming down a hill, and I had a lot of speed, but off to my right, I saw a tractor trailer, and I probably had plenty of time to cross the highway. But the lesson that I had learned was, you know what? there's no point in tempting fate. If I go across that road and I got plenty of time, but that tractor trailer is not too far away, if anything bad happens, I'm a squished bug. And the point is that we have to learn these lessons because we don't know when the bad thing is going to happen, when that devil ex machina is going to come down. And that's really the point. We don't know when that's going to happen. All we can do is control our environment, live by certain rules, or manage by certain rules. So with that said, let's move on to some bad experiences that I saw happen in Pennsylvania. And I'm talking about a few of these, and they are PIC, the Physicians Insurance Company, Reliance Insurance Company, FICO, Legion, the State Workers Insurance Fund, Special Funds, and Medical Malpractice, in no particular order. PIC. And actually, the good news is I promise that we will get out of here early, not late. So I'll keep you attentive by saying that. But in any event, PIC. PIC was a medical malpractice writer, and actually, arguably, on a personal side, I actually kind of thought that they suffered from a bit of hubris. But they were a medical malpractice writer. They were one of the first companies in Pennsylvania to discount their reserves, their medical malpractice reserves. And in fact, and remember, they came into existence before risk-based capital. In fact, if you look closely at their balance sheet, all of their surplus was entirely due to the discounting of the reserves. They eventually developed that they had reserve deficiencies. They were downgraded. Doctors didn't care. Doctors don't care. Doctors don't care about the quality, generally the quality of the paper that their coverage is written on. Doctors are forced to buy a product. Doctors want it as cheap as possible. What did happen to them? There had been a backlog in court cases in Philadelphia that all of a sudden the court system, the judicial system decided something had to be done about it. They accelerated the cases. When those cases were all accelerated, it forced the PIC to liquidate its holdings of bonds at a distressed rate. Coincidentally, at the same time, risk-based capital was introduced. Those two factors caused them to go into insolvency. And if we step back and think about it, clearly, actuaries know that medical malpractice is, how can you forecast payments? We can say historically what the payment pattern is, but it's not like workers' comp where there's a schedule of payments. It's very, very, very volatile. So to assume that there's a payout pattern that you can apply to discount reserves when you write in one state and generally in one locale and one judicial system, but it's easy to be a Tuesday morning quarterback. It's easy to be that. But in any event, let's look at Reliance. Reliance actually was a terrific company in many ways. I started there. And let's face it, Saul Steinberg was an incredible financier who bought that company by a leveraged buyout. And actually, we're here in Disney World. He greenmailed Disney once and made a ton of money. And I won't tell you some of the jokes that there had been some articles released in the paper about the darker side of his life. So we had some jokes going around the actuarial department about if he actually succeeded Disney, what kind of movies would Mickey and Minnie be in? But we won't talk about that either. In any event, Reliance was a multi-line writer, and its business was very rating sensitive. But a critical item, it was heavily, heavily, heavily leveraged by reinsurance. And it was heavily leveraged by holding company debt. A couple things happened along the way. Unicover, basically Saul got into a fray with a financier who was much better than him and much shrewder, Warren Buffett. It just so happened that there were some reserve deficiencies, and Reliance got downgraded. And when it got downgraded, the cash flow coming into the company, because the business was rating sensitive, diminished, dropped to almost nothing. And when that happens, reinsurers cease to be netting premiums versus payments, all of a sudden everything backs up. And if you are as incredibly leveraged as Reliance was, all of a sudden liquidity becomes a crisis. And that's what happened to Reliance. But it's easy to be a Tuesday morning quarterback. FICO. It's interesting about FICO because this is really the one opposite case on the screen. FICO was a medical malpractice rider. It rapidly expanded into new markets. And that was problematic because it really had no idea what it was doing. I mean, I'm saying that some people at FICO may say otherwise, but from being a Tuesday morning quarterback, I don't know how you would have known what you should have been charging in those markets or what the reserve should have been. And in fact, in retrospect, that is the case. Reserve deficiencies developed. They were downgraded. And doctors, again, really didn't care. And liquidity was not a problem there. In fact, the real issue at FICO was, at the end of the day, when you looked at the balance sheet, when the reserves were more accurately stated, the liabilities exceeded the assets. But that company has been reasonably well managed through insolvency by the state, and it's coming through the other end in a manageable fashion. You have to step back and think about FICO, though, and think about the bicycle example. FICO was a company that was basically owned by the Hospital Association of Pennsylvania. And its any earnings were dividended up to the holding company to support the holding company. And so, just as an aside, I often wondered, wasn't there a little bit of a loss of focus on what your goals were and your mission to try to compete in these other marketplaces to grow and lose sight of what your core mission was, which is kind of interesting because on the way down here, I read an article about Clif Bars. Anybody know what Clif Bars are? And Clif Bars, there was a time when there was an opportunity for the owner of Clif Bars to sell the company for $60 million. And he almost did it, but then he stepped back and decided that really, if he did that, he would be going against his original mission and notion and focus, and he would have been disloyal to his employees. And he decided not to do it. And it actually turned out to be a good economic decision that he decided not to do it. And it was a case where they didn't lose focus on what their original mission was. But the notion about FICO is, again, that FICO is probably the poster child for a situation, the classic situation, where reserves simply proved to be deficient. Legion, a mini Reliance. It was a multi-line rider again. Its business was rating sensitive. It was heavily leveraged by reinsurance. That seems to be a common theme in the two significant insolvencies that had happened in Pennsylvania. It was downgraded. Reserves, I mean, the reality is no one knows what the reserve should have been. And it's still a difficult process to understand what they should be because all the losses were managed by general agents. There were no actuaries in-house. And today, now I've been away for a couple years, but at the end of the day, to get your hand in an actuarial sense around what the reserve should have been is a very difficult process. The issue at Legion is all liquidity. Liquidity, 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 and driven by the incredible leveraging by reinsurance and the effect of a downgrade. So, what are common themes? Well, we see reserve deficiencies throughout this, but really there's only one occasion when the reserve deficiency in and of itself arguably caused the insolvency, and that's FICO. In the other cases, it's losing focus on some of those conventional wisdom that you really don't need numbers to understand and manage. Don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying numbers and modern techniques are not useful. Rating downgrades were critical. Reinsurance and liquidity were critical issues. getting on to the notion, though, of correlations and diversifications, they don't just exist in the private sector. These are notions that we have to look for and understand everywhere. And, for example, at the State Workers Insurance Fund, where I did a lot of actuarial work, it was consistently a leading writer of workers' comp in Pennsylvania, and it was often the leading writer. Its market share has varied from 5 to 15%. And when I originally made this slide, it was about 13%. Today, it's back up to close to 20%. It has experienced dramatic premium growth to almost $500 million in 1994. Then there was a precipitous drop after some reform, but now it's back up to those $500 million levels. And this graph goes through 98, and it shows you the cyclicality of the premium. And in fact, if I continued it through 2007, you'd see that we were back up at the peak. But this is really the slide that I want to show you. It's something that is very interesting because it reflects the kind of the shock absorber effect of SWIFT and what it really is and how there has to be an understanding of these correlations within an organization, in this case, the government. This is a slide that shows the relationship between SWIFT's exposures and the Pennsylvania unemployment rate. And we could duplicate this slide with frequency of claims, and we could duplicate the slide with several other things. Now, there'd be a time lag, but the point here is that SWIFT's experience is very dependent on the economic health of the Commonwealth. And that's a very important notion because you have a lot of pressures within the State Workers Insurance Fund to do from different parties to take different courses of action in these crises. For example, and we all know that politics, some people say it's an ugly word. I don't know if it's ugly or not. Politics is a reality, and we live in a terrific country because we're kind of ad hoc, and we live ad hoc in a political sense, and we're smart enough to know that we can't forecast the future with complete accuracy, and we kind of go along in this ad hoc fashion, and that's why we have politicians. Well, take the State Workers Insurance Fund. Politicians need to get elected. They need advertising capital to get elected. One of the groups they get it from is investment managers. So those investment managers get rewarded by managing pots of money for the Commonwealth. Now, to manage money for the Commonwealth, you make more money if you buy and sell than if you simply sit and look at the money. So where would you buy and sell? You'd buy and sell equities. You wouldn't buy and sell bonds. And if you're going to manage bonds, generally you're not going to be able to necessarily make the returns that you might make in certain periods of time or might be expected to make. So there's a tension brewing in the group of people who manage an organization like the State Workers Insurance Fund, because you have one group who is managing the capital, who would like to invest more money in equities so that they can make more money by buying and selling, and so that they also have a greater opportunity to earn more money to meet their target goals. On the other hand, they want to insulate themselves from failings by saying, the liabilities are exceeding the assets. You need to raise rates. What is the last thing a politician wants to do when he wants to get reelected at a time the economy is going south? He doesn't want to raise rates because those workers' comp rates are another tax on the employers in the Commonwealth. And it doesn't matter if he's a Democrat or a Republican. So you can see that these interactions, they don't just happen in the private sector. They happen everywhere. And they have to be managed. Pennsylvania experienced medical malpractice. There was a medical malpractice crisis in Pennsylvania. It's kind of diminished at the moment as far as the vocalization in the media. However, one of the common themes throughout the crisis was that the reason for the crisis was that the medical malpractice insurers had lost money in imprudent investments. Well, the fact is, in fact, that medical malpractice insurers generally are not big insurers. They're small insurers, and particularly in Pennsylvania. And they invest in very conservative assets in bonds, as this graph should show. But the problem with that is that they are very, very sensitive to the yields on bonds. And in fact, if the bond rates drop from 7 to 4%, that has a tremendous impact on what medical malpractice insurers, and if future expectations as to those rates drop from 7 to 4, that has a huge impact on what those medical malpractice writers are going to charge for their product. And that in and of itself explains why there's a huge part of the change in rates and what the physicians see in the marketplace. And it's not from imprudent investments in the sense that they're speculating on basically equities and imprudent bonds. I wanted to focus in on some of these liquidity issues for a moment. If we look here, this is kind of back at the time of Reliance's insolvency. This looks at this pie chart shows the industry asset distribution. And if you'll notice that about 54% of the industry's assets were in bonds and another 18% stocks. If we look at that a little bit differently and we look at invested assets, and here I mean those assets that are cash, near cash equivalent, or financial instruments, we see that all of a sudden the bond component jumps up to 67%. And equities are about 22%. If we look at Reliance, and I like this pie chart because look now, if we just look at Reliance a little bit differently, and look how much it had in reinsurance recoverables as an asset. About 70% of its assets were in reinsurance recoverables. There's a huge credit risk there and a huge timing risk. And that was atypical of the industry, I think. So if you take reinsurance leverage and you add rating-sensitive business, you mix in a downgrade, and you have $1 billion or more in statutory deposits. Statutory deposits, theoretically, they're there to protect policyholders, but they can't be touched. They can't be liquidated until the commissioners in all the states are happy that you got a plan. So they could be in the most liquid asset, but darn it, they ain't liquid. And you have $500,000 in one stock. Well, what the heck is your liquidity doing? You don't have any, and that's pretty much what happened to Reliance. And this graph just once again focuses in on that that the importance of the reinsurance leverage. At the time that Reliance went through this experience at the department, we did some analysis to grapple with this issue of reinsurance leverage and to see what we were going to do going forward and what kind of positions we should take or suggestions we should make. And we did some analysis, and I'm just sharing some of that with you. And basically, we looked at ratios, leverage ratios, where we looked at the cumulative percent of gross premiums written to net premiums. And we looked at the cumulative percent of the industry that was written on a gross basis at different leverage ratios. And you can see that really most of the industry did not write at the leverage ratio that Reliance was at the time. That, in fact, if you follow this graph, I think it suggests that about 90% of the industry wrote at a leverage ratio less than 6, and Reliance was that or above. And this one does this, looks at the same thing for reserves. At the same time, this graph shows the distribution of companies according to risk-based capital ranges. And really, the point of this graph and these two graphs is that really risk-based capital and some of the other tools at the time, sure, they had quote-unquote liquidity measures in them, but arguably, from my perspective and a couple other people at the insurance department's perspective, not the liquidity measures that would have allowed us to, in a priori, filter out Reliance as being a company that was potentially at risk. Just another graph along that theme. Now, speaking of these kinds of issues, the state has a fund, a workers' comp security fund. And basically, this is a fund that guarantees workers' comp payments if a company goes insolvent and can't meet the claims. And in fact, this fund was activated in the case of Reliance and Legion, a couple other things. The fund has a trigger in it. And the trigger by law says that if the fund's value drops below, and I think it's $500 million by a certain percent, then there has to be an assessment on all insurers in the Commonwealth to bring the fund back up. The purpose of the fund is to guarantee kind of a shock absorber be there so that the fund needs to be activated, it can, or needs to provide support for these claims, it's there. And it's there in advance, and it was there based on attacks on insurance companies to begin with. Well, let's remember what I said about politics and investment managers. Well, the fund decided to invest because of pressure from investment managers and equities, and that proportion of equities grew to almost 50%. What is the risk then to insurers in the Commonwealth? Because of the language in the triggering mechanism and the volatility of equities, there could be incredible collections resulting from a drop one day in the stock market and no way to redistribute gains from the fund back to the companies if the stock market another time went up. So sometimes we create these kind of crises ourselves. So what are the conclusions? Well, covariances among risk elements always exist. Some are naturally occurring. Some are artificially created. But the important thing is that interactions among them without them being managed and tested for can lead to some pretty disastrous results. And we've seen that in the case of Pennsylvania. And any insight? Well, the insight would be, again, that these covariances and risk elements must be identified and managed. So at this point, we have some time left if you have questions, or we can simply adjourn. Thank you. Questions?
You just gave a terrific presentation. What are you going to do next? Go to Disney World. Okay, I like that line. Oh. Well, I'd like to, any other questions? I'd like to thank you for spending some time with us before you head off to your activities and things of that sort. So if you could join me in Jeff giving his insights. Thank you for attending. I hope you have a great afternoon, and we'll see you this evening. Thanks. Take care.